I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A teenage girl who was forced to have sex with as many as 1,000 men over a two-year period is suing a motel for renting rooms to her traffickers, knowing that she was being sexually exploited. This is a new and untested law in Pennsylvania, and the motel, Roosevelt Inn on Route 1 in Philadelphia, has the reputation for being the, quote, local epicenter for human trafficking. It's on a busy road near malls and supermarkets, auto dealers, and other motels. In other words, it's in a public place where people come and go every day, and yet this young teenager was essentially a prisoner. We're going to talk about sex trafficking, an underreported and misunderstood crime, and we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Shay Rhodes is director and co-founder of the Villanova Law Institute to address commercial sexual exploitation. Shay Rhodes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having
me. You're very welcome. Also with us is Erin O'Brien, and she is Assistant Chief of the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. And Erin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And our third guest is Jamie Manera-Kiza, and she's Director of Anti-Trafficking for the Salvation Army's New Day to Stop Trafficking program. And Jamie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great, thank you.
Where to begin? Well, let's begin with the little that we know about this young girl who, according to the couple of reports that I read, was sold into slavery. That's a quote there, at the age of 14. Should we be shocked by that, Shay, that she was so young and she was sold?
We should be shocked, yes, absolutely. I mean, she's a child, a rape victim.
And I guess what I mean by shocked is shocked that we're talking about something happening not just in the United States of America, but here in Philadelphia.
It's happening nationally in Philadelphia and all throughout Pennsylvania. And 14, which is terrifying,
yes,
is not an uncommon age.
Do we know how many young women, young men, young adults are trafficked in Pennsylvania? Do we have those numbers? I'm assuming they'd be hard to come by.
They are hard to come by. I mean, the sex industry is an underground industry, and it's really difficult to try to pinpoint and put specific numbers on, you know, the epidemic, quite frankly.
And Jamie, again, there's much we do not know, and we're not going to be talking about this young woman because there's much we do not know about her, but you work with people who have been trafficked. What do we need to know and understand about them?
Yeah, so I think that through our work, we serve, we do a comprehensive victim services all throughout the city and surrounding counties. And so we see a number of cases, but we've had victims enrolled in our program as young as 12 and 13 years old, which is kind of nationally the quoted age of entry, and it varies between 11 to 13.
The age of entry.
Yes. Yeah. And so we've seen victims at that age. We've also worked with a lot of victims, maybe 15, 16, at which point, you know, somebody identified them. And we work with women who are adults in their 20s who no one ever identified. And the common denominator is just, you know, individuals who have experienced any sort of a vulnerability and that was preyed upon, you know, by a trafficker, a pimp, or a perpetrator, you know, who lured them into the life.
So someone that may have run away from home or may be experiencing problems at home?
Yes, I definitely think that homelessness, being in some sort of the dependency system in child welfare, creates a vulnerability more so than maybe another youth. But we've had individuals who have been trafficked who come from all sorts of backgrounds, and that's been the most eye-opening thing. I know for me as a service provider and just as a common citizen is that we've had individuals who have come from, you know, really solid families, who have come from wealthy neighborhoods, lower-income neighborhoods, any sort of background we've really probably touched upon at this point in our work.
One of the things we were talking about before going on the air, and Erin, I'll put this to you, which is just, I focused on this one motel in this one section of Route 1 here in Philadelphia, but you all were telling me about the various sort of hot spots in this region that seem to be places where people are sex trafficked. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, what we're seeing is hotels around the city, hotels in areas near airports, near sporting events, where there's a bunch of hotels in a small area. So there's a stretch of Route 1 in Northeast Philadelphia where we see a number of hotels come into play during investigations. Hotels by the airport that extend into Delaware County, Tinicum Township, and then hotels in other pockets of the city down by the stadiums in going into West Philadelphia or along City Line Avenue, areas where there are smaller hotels or hotels in a cluster close together.
And is it because they're near stadiums, they're near highway intersections? Is that a bit of a clue?
I think it's where there's easy access to get to the hotels. So it's right off the highway and there's a number of them in close proximity. People know how to get there. There's easy access for the traffickers to move people from one location to another location that's very close by. We see it for a number of reasons, but I think access is the biggest one.
And Shay, how would someone looking to have sex, let's say with a minor, someone who's a teenager, mm-hmm. how would they know to go to some of these places that we've been talking about? How would they know that?
Well, the internet is the new street corner. Everyone knows that. And if you're looking to buy sex right now, the majority of those advertisements are on Backpage.com. There's been a lot of litigation surrounding Backpage. And Backpage sort of gave us a false victory in the sense that they took down their adult escort section, but everything moved over to dating and massage. So if you want, if you're in the market to purchase sex, you go on Backpage, you make a phone call, and they'll tell you where they are, and that's where you go.
Are there certain code words?
Well, sure. I mean, Backpage, one of the reasons why they can't hide behind the Communications Decency Act anymore is because they were sanitizing their ads. They were getting involved in that user content. But Young, not spelled Y-O-U-N-G, but Y-U-N-G. New in town. Fresh. Barely legal. That was one that they were leaving in for a while and then took out. But if you just put B-R-L-Y-L-G-L, they weren't hitting up. But you can also look at the photographs. And the photographs indicate, you know, she'll say she's 18 or 19, but she looks younger. You can tell immediately.
I was looking. This has gotten some coverage in something that was in the Washington Post. These were some of the reviews on Yelp and TripAdvisor at this about this Roosevelt Inn. One of the people that stay there said, this is a drug-infested, crime-ridden, prostitution-laced place. Another guest said, one thing that made us very uncomfortable was that there were a lot of girls coming in and out all the time. Another one wrote, no security at all. These girls are letting their johns in through the doors that are unlocked. The smell of marijuana throughout the place is disgusting. Talking about working girls and pimps running amok, half-naked through the hallways. Another one said, please do not bring your kids here. So this is happening in plain sight. I mean, that, I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to do the show, which is to say it's not happening in another country. It's not happening down a dark road somewhere. It's happening, for instance, in a motel where people are coming and going. People are renting rooms there that are not looking to have or pay for sex. They're there to spend the night. Can I toss that over to you, Jamie? And just in terms of just how public this is and why someone might post this on Yelp, but they wouldn't call the cops.
Well, so, I mean, I think that what we've seen for a long time is that sex trafficking has been happening in our communities, both through the internet, but even in the work that we do. We have a center in Kensington, so that's an open air or street track, and there's women out in visible plain sight every day. We see upwards of 50 women sometimes a day at our location. And then if you go to other sections, as we've mentioned, in the city, we see women both in these hotels, massage parlors, in calls, out calls. And I think that, you know, trafficking is a hidden crime for many reasons that I'm sure both of our attorneys could speak to. But, you know, people, part of the challenge I know on a victim services side is that victims don't often identify as a victim because of all of the conditioning and trauma bonding that traffickers have put into them. And so they're not calling law enforcement saying, help me, and nobody's really reporting it.
I want to pick up on that, but let me go to you if I can, Aaron, just sort of helping us understand why there seems to be some kind of reluctance to either call the cops in this case or to somehow get involved in the fact that we're talking about, in many cases, teenage girls who are being sex trafficked. Why don't we take that more seriously?
Well, I think one of the issues that we have is, as a society, when we hear about this, people are incredibly concerned and they want to do something. And you have this dichotomy where then when you see it in a hotel and you have these people who are writing these complaints, these reviews, they're not
seeing
those
girls.
Stop sign.
What was the weather?
Well, I'm sorry.
They're not seeing those girls as victims.
They're not.
They're seeing them as women or young girls who are committing a crime in the hotel, who are actually the problem. So if they're trying to get involved, they're not trying to get involved to help those girls. They're identifying them as the problem. And so when the police would be notified, they'd be notified with them as the problem, as them as the people that need to be, you know, removed from the hotel. Something needs to be done. So we have victims who don't identify as victims, and we have on a real basis, when people encounter them, they're not identifying them as victims either.
They're seeing them as part of the problem. Do you want to add to that, Shay?
Sure. I mean, prostitution, quite frankly, is how sex trafficking presents to the public. And Aaron is spot on. Prostitution is a crime. And, you know, we're working here in Pennsylvania to give children immunity for that crime. A new bill was introduced last week, Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Children. But there's a lot of drug activity that surrounds prostitution and prostituted people. Traffickers know this. It's actually part of our trafficking statute here in Pennsylvania. One of the means is facilitating or controlling access to a controlled substance. And as everyone knows, we have a huge heroin epidemic going on nationally. And traffickers are deliberately addicting their victims to heroin, keeping them dope sick in hotel rooms. But it's interesting because you said that, you know, according to those reviews, TripAdvisor, Yelp, that they're letting the Johns in.
Exactly.
Well, let's just call them what they really are. They're sex buyers. And buying sex is also a crime. So, you know, they're the ones that perpetuate this industry. Pimps and brothel owners get to make a lot of money. I believe the last numbers we had on that was human trafficking is a $150 billion worldwide industry.
Wow.
It's because there's demand for it.
Right.
And if we eliminate the demand or go after the demand and target them because it's a crime, then sex trafficking hopefully will go down.
And I do want to pick up on that. Language is important. Should we use the word sex trafficking versus prostitution? Is there a difference?
Well,
we're almost up in a break, but go ahead, Jay.
Sure. I refer to people who are prostituting or being sold for sex as prostituted persons. They're not prostitutes. I think it's demeaning. That's my personal opinion. You know, those who purchase sex are called Johns. He gets a name. I understand it's the anonymity involved, et cetera, but he's a sex buyer. Let's just call it
a
what it is.
A sex buyer.
He's a sex buyer. And I say he because it's predominantly men that are purchasing sex. But, you know, law enforcement here in Philadelphia and throughout Pennsylvania has done a really good job in shifting it. They now go after those that buy sex and attempt to engage the prostituted person with the help that they need, you know, either through Jamie and the Salvation Army or, you know, throughout the state, other victim service providers.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We are talking about sex trafficking here in the Philadelphia area with Shay Rhodes, with Jamie Manera Kiza, and with Aaron O'Brien. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes and call our comment line 267-405-20. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about sex trafficking in the Philadelphia region, how it occurs, and the steps to end sexual exploitation and enslavement. It's an important topic that gets little attention. And let me introduce our three guests. Shay Rhodes is director and co-founder of the Villanova Law Institute to address commercial sexual exploitation. Aaron O'Brien is assistant chief of the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. And Jamie Manera Kiza is director of anti-trafficking for the Salvation Army's New Day to Stop Trafficking program. And again, any questions or comments, you can call our comment line, and that's 267-405-2006. Jimmy, let me go back to you. When you mentioned the kind of control that a trafficker often has or generally has over someone who is being trafficked, and we should say we're talking about girls and young women or women, but we're also talking about boys as well. Help us understand what that control entails.
Sure. I think that the control factors are commonly misunderstood. which also makes the crime overlooked or victims overlooked. And so control entails sort of this grooming phase that traffickers will use in terms of kind of recruiting a victim. So if we just take a case scenario of, say, a runaway youth, a vulnerable individual, that trafficker is going to be a mastermind manipulator who is going to not only try to get in her mind emotionally and psychologically, preying upon her vulnerabilities of security, safety, but he might also prey upon her need for shelter, her need for food, clothing.
So he seems like a benign presence in the beginning to take care of somebody.
Yes, and oftentimes traffickers present at first as a boyfriend, and girls will talk to us about, he's my boyfriend. And that's often also how victims refer sometimes to their trafficker. They don't say, he's my trafficker, certainly, most often not. I don't want to say that could never happen, although it has not in 7 years that I've worked in this field. So it's a boyfriend, or it's a fiance. And so he's presented during this grooming phase as somebody that really cares and builds a loving familial type relationship. And then there's often a turning out phase that might include psychological threats, threatening of family members, threatening of their own life. It might include kind of a beating of another girl that the pimp has already recruited in front of that girl to kind of show her what will happen to her if she doesn't want to comply. It might also be physical abuse to that victim as well. It might be gang rape. We've seen a lot of different methods of torture. But I think it's also important to recognize that the psychological control and coercion that creates this Stockholm syndrome and this trauma bond is not visible and yet very, very deep and controlling.
And the Stockholm syndrome is literally people who have been held captive, who begin to see their captor as their, not ally, but someone they can turn to.
Yeah, definitely. So we've had girls say that, like, you know, yeah, he did beat me, but he also, you know, he was the only one there for me when I most needed someone. He was the only one there for me who cared when my parents kicked me out. So they both associate him as somebody who's threatened them, but then he makes sure to overpower those thoughts of threats with the love that I showed you or the loyalty that I've showed you. And is able to really control people that way.
We were talking about sex trafficking, prostitution. I mean, in many ways, Erin, this sounds like a form of slavery. I mean, you are owned by somebody who controls your life and hurts you.
Absolutely. That's absolutely what it is. And I think the new laws in Pennsylvania really have actually written that in. We have a statute in Pennsylvania now specifically called involuntary servitude. We charge it when we charge trafficking cases because that's what it is. It's exploiting somebody. It's taking advantage of them. It's holding them against their will to make money off of them. And we see victims, as Jamie's just said, who really identify with the perpetrator. They identify with the trafficker. They may have been raised or have had a recent experience where they don't necessarily trust law enforcement. They have a distrust of the system as a whole, and they have a loyalty and, to some degree, affection or what they believe is love for the person that's done these things to them. And it's really hard to build a rapport with law enforcement or with the criminal justice system to get them to come forward.
I wonder, Shay, I mean, it seems like what this teenager, unnamed teenager, is doing in terms of suing this motel on Roosevelt Boulevard in Philadelphia, seems it is a bit of a test case for a Pennsylvania law. Is this, and basically saying that if you're running this motel and you're seeing all this activity that we've been talking about, then you know what's going on. Is this an important test case, you think?
I think it's incredibly important. I mean, it's putting the hotel industry in Pennsylvania and nationally on notice. If you allow this to go on within your hotel, you know, where do hotels get hurt? You can't put a hotel in jail.
Right.
I mean, certain hotel employees, in my opinion, and have throughout the Commonwealth been part of a trafficking investigation and prosecution, but you hit them in their pocketbooks. You shut this down. The Roosevelt Inn is absolutely one of the most notorious hotels that this has been happening for as long as I've been having human trafficking on my radar, almost 7 years at this point. And, you know, the district attorney's office prosecuted a shooting at that very hotel that hit national news. You can YouTube the video and see in that video a young, what appears to be a young woman, might be a teenager running down the hall in very provocative-looking clothing. This has been going on at that hotel for a long time.
Which raises a question, Aaron, why is it still open? I know you can't answer that, but
I think we do have remedies under the law to go after the hotels, but our priority is going after the traffickers. And so when we're doing these investigations and when we're trying to build rapport with the victims and to bring cases to justice, the first priority has to be going after the traffickers. And I think this, Shay is right. This is a good way to put a stop to these hotels, going after them where it hurts, which for them is in the purse. And for the traffickers is holding them accountable and making sure that that justice is done for their victims.
If we're talking about traffickers, are these organized syndicates or gangs or groups of people, or is it more an individual that is trafficking a couple of girls, let's say? Can I go back to you, Aaron?
I think it's important to keep an open mind and understand that we can see any of those things. What we have seen anecdotally in Philadelphia is individuals who may work or connect with other individuals or smaller groups of people, but we're seeing a lot of people who realize that they can do this and they can make money, and they may just start recruiting people. They may start out with one victim and have several victims as time goes by. But we're not seeing at this point that we've prosecuted large criminal organizations.
Let me read an email from Jose. Please expand your conversation to include handicapped women, or I guess women with disabilities. I was also wondering, Jamie, about people who are here undocumented. Are they also potentially at risk?
Yeah, absolutely. So persons with disabilities, we've definitely seen, particularly sometimes in our drop-in center, we have seen and serve women. We've also seen cases, of course, of individuals who are undocumented, and that makes them more vulnerable because it adds another layer of feeling like there's maybe not a voice, they don't know who to turn to, easier to be isolated by a trafficker and kind of manipulated or preyed upon. And those are all common denominators for preying upon victims, but when you add lack of documentation, mm-hmm. you make that person more vulnerable.
An email from Peter. Every year before the Super Bowl, press conferences are held to publicize and promise a crackdown on human trafficking, and every year the results are underwhelming. What is going wrong that authorities cannot find the prostitution going on incidental to an event like the Super Bowl? Which is something we touched on earlier. Perhaps, Jay, I can go back to you,
sure.
Which is, I mean, I hear from both you and Aaron that law enforcement is trying mm-hmm. to take this more seriously and to go after the traffickers, I guess, and the Johns or the people that are buying sex. But is that enough?
I think that the Super Bowl is an example of a type of event that's happening that pulls in the demand. So traffickers capitalize on that. This year, the Super Bowl was in Houston. When you have an influx of demand, you know, going to the Super Bowl, have a lot of money, it's a largely male, you know, individuals who are attending the event. There's a small supply, meaning individuals who are sold for sex in Houston. So traffickers capitalize on that, and they will travel in with their stable to meet the demand that is, you know, coming into Houston. I think the Super Bowl has done a great job of bringing awareness mm-hmm. to the crime of human trafficking and saying we're not going to tolerate it at our events in these cities. And I don't necessarily know if I would consider the results underwhelming. I mean, the National John Suppression Initiative, you know, puts the numbers out every year, and a large number of traffickers and individuals who've been trafficked have been recovered during the Super Bowl. But I think that that's just indicative of sort of a climate, right? A big sporting event, influx of men to that area. Boys will be boys. I want to have a good time. Strip clubs, sex, it all goes hand in hand in hand. And so I think that the Super Bowl has done a great job in raising awareness. You know, this is an event. Mm-hmm. We know it happens. And just, you know, blasting out the human trafficking hotline number. If you see something, say something, report it. And they do recover a lot of victims during not just the Super Bowl, but big events like that.
That's Shay Rhodes, who joins us with Jamie Manera Kiza and also Aaron O'Brien, and we are talking about sex trafficking, focusing largely on the Philadelphia area. And again, you can join our conversation by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. What do you think should be done about sex trafficking here in the Philadelphia area? As you all were talking, and I'll put this to you, Aaron, I was thinking, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, I was out in Las Vegas, and I saw giant billboards for girls, for women. They were trucks and cars going through town, just driving around with a picture of a rather youngish-looking girl. I'm not saying she was necessarily a teenager, basically saying, you know, sex for sale or call this number. Again, something happening out in the public for all the public to see, and yet clearly no one was caught pulling over these cars and trying to figure out what was going on here.
I think one of the biggest changes we've seen in the last several years is awareness that we're starting to see more people and more articles, more coverage of this as a problem, of showing that these young women, young men, adult women, that they're being victimized, that they're being trafficked, that this isn't something that they're entering into willingly or that they're able to leave if they want to do that. So I think the biggest thing that we can continue to do is bring awareness to this issue so that when people do see something, they will say something. So we won't have things like those Yelp reviews. We'll have people who are calling the police to get help for the women that they're seeing.
And Jamie, we've talked largely about girls and women, but we should also talk about boys. Is it the same kind of route into sex trafficking for boys as it is for girls?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that just speaking anecdotally from our experiences, we've had a much less number of boys that have been referred to our program and have been identified. But I would say that the ones that we have had have similar, you know, have grooming phases, have somebody that, you know, lured them in with some sort of false promise or pretense, and then turned on them. And then there's the elements of force, fraud, and coercion used as well. And I would think that the fact that we have a less number of cases doesn't necessarily mean that there's a less victims out there, but that, you know, we haven't been as keen in many avenues, both from law enforcement, community members, service providers, in identifying and talking about the issue with boys. And I also think that boys, there's another element of hiding that is being added to that.
You want to add to that, Shane?
I mean, Erin's probably, you know, she's been a child sex abuse prosecutor for, I guess, a decade now. But I think that statistically, if you look at the reports of child sex abuse, the numbers of boys who report child sex abuse are lower than girls. There's stigma, there's shame. There's that with girls as well. But the underreporting of child sex abuse that happens with boys is something that we really need to encourage kids, boys specifically, to come forward. And like Jamie said, you know, it's done in the same fashion. You know, you have homeless, runaway youth trading sex just for basic survival needs, and boys are engaging that as well.
Should we see then that connection between child sex abuse and sex trafficking, Erin?
Absolutely, we see that connection. We see victims who are unfortunately victims as children who are looking for someone to take care of them. They're looking for someone to show them affection. They're unfortunately falling victim to that boyfriend trap that Jamie already spoke about, which is children who have long felt that they had no support at home, couldn't stay at home, are looking for a place to go. And that gives them a vulnerability that makes them prey for these traffickers.
I'm thinking, and Jamie, I mean, some people leave, they get out. I mean, what is it? And even reading about this young woman that's part of this lawsuit, was it sounds like she was really kept in this motel or other motels and not allowed to leave. How does someone get out of this? And is it sort of looking for that moment of escape?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes, you know, in movies and whatnot of trafficking, we see the sensationalism of escaping or chains. And I think that I can't emphasize enough the kind of psychological bondage that is not visible to the naked eye, but is really the bondage that people have to escape from. or have to confront in leaving a trafficker, right?
And confront maybe even in themselves,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah, and confront as the trafficker tries to lure them back, because he will. And so what we see is it's a process. So leaving is a process, and leaving oftentimes entails recidivism, going back to the life, going back to things that were familiar. And so as a victim service provider, and as a system and as community members, we can't emphasize enough that you need to be prepared to engage in that process with survivors, that aftercare is not just a simple solution of right. We're going to give you housing and everything's great now. It's a process of a tug of war because their pimp put a lot of effort and energy into conditioning that person. And we know that psychological conditioning and manipulation takes a long time to unwind.
You want to add to that, Erin, in terms of from the work that you've done as part of the district attorney's office?
I think Jamie's points are really important ones to keep in mind, which is that I think as society we see that when somebody is out or when the police have located a victim, people expect them to be thankful and to feel rescued and not want to go back and not want to see those people ever again. And we're talking a lot of times about victims who have no one else. These are the people that they see as their family. And when you say, we've rescued you, you never have to see them again, that's not always seen that way. And that there may have been things that they saw as good things with those relationships. And you're taking those things away as well. So you have to have this patience and understanding that you may have a victim who isn't ready to be out, who isn't ready to say goodbye to those people forever, and may come back a few times before they're really ready to make that change.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about sex trafficking, focusing largely on the Philadelphia region, how it occurs, and the steps to end sexual exploitation, even enslavement, such an important use of words here. And that's Erin O'Brien. She's Assistant Chief of the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. Jamie Manekazera is Director of Anti-Trafficking for the Salvation Army's New Day to Stop Trafficking Program, and Shay Rhodes, Director and Co-Founder of the Villanova Law Institute to Address Commercial Sexual Exploitation. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jamie Manera-Kiza and Erin O'Brien and Shay Rhodes about sex trafficking here in the Philadelphia area. Shay, we were talking earlier about the Super Bowl. We actually had a comment about that. Do you want to respond?
Sure. So I was able to locate the press release put out by the Cook County Sheriff's Office, which is the law enforcement agency that runs the National John Suppression Initiative every year. And this year they ran that initiative from January 18th through February 5th, which was Super Bowl Sunday this year in Houston. It included 30 law enforcement agencies across 15 states. And throughout that initiative, over 700 sex buyers were arrested and 29 pimps and traffickers. But specific to that Houston area or Harris County, Texas, there were 178 sex buyers arrested. Mm-hmm. And that's from the Harris County Sheriff's Office. And then the Houston Police Department reported 105 sex buyers arrested. What's interesting is that, you know, this is a violent industry. And unfortunately, one of the persons being sold for sex in Houston was actually shot in the head by a local sex buyer who was arrested. So this is not, you know, a glamorous industry. This is incredibly violent. It's, you know, absolutely happening in Philadelphia. It's absolutely happening in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania agencies, law enforcement agencies that participate in the National John Suppression Initiative are the Pittsburgh Police Department and the Upper Marion Township Police Department. And in Pittsburgh, 18 sex buyers were arrested, and 3 sex buyers were arrested in Upper Marion, which is, you know, King of Prussia, right around the corner here.
Absolutely. I mean, Erin, Shay talked in terms of supply and demand. I mean, certain ways, by focusing on demand, is that where you think the most progress can be made?
I definitely think we can make a significant amount of progress focusing on demand. I think it's sometimes harder for us to locate victims when we're focusing on demand, because those operations are a little harder to organize in terms of locating victims. And if our focus is in going out and finding the victims as opposed to just looking to make arrests, we have to do both of those things so that we can come in contact with these women and children.
Let me read an email from Margie who says, PennDOT has recognized the role that truckers can play in recognizing sex trafficking and has launched an excellent education campaign. It was announced this March. Check it out. You're nodding your head, Shay.
We worked with Secretary Richard's staff at PennDOT to create that trafficking curriculum, and they engaged also the Blue Campaign. But this is something that's incredibly important to Secretary Richards. I mean, she understands so much that, you know, one of the acts necessary or that you can make out in the law, you need an act by means. Those means are force, fraud, and coercion for the purpose of commercial sex. And one of those acts is transporting.
Right.
And the transportation industry, by engaging, they intend to train all of their staff, including those at the DMV locations, right, to recognize the signs of sex trafficking. And, you know, we all have to get from point A to point B to get anywhere in this world. And for her to really engage and get behind this as one of her initiatives is incredible. And I really give her kudos.
For doing that. What's the difference, Jamie, for someone then who is a survivor? I mean, that's such a, we talk about language here. It's such a powerful word. Someone who's a victim versus a survivor. And you describe this really complicated relationship between someone who is sex trafficked and their sex trafficker. What does it take for them to not just sort of break those bonds, but also to begin to rebuild their life and think of themselves as a survivor?
So I think that's an individual path for everybody. And there's no clean cut plan for all individuals is what we found.
Sure.
But what we have found is that individuals need a lot of comprehensive services that are meeting them where they're at in their process and in their journey. So not asking them to fit into a mold that we create, but really creating a service model that individuals can create their own plan for recovery. What we found is that traffickers take away choice and take away power. And so individuals have to be able to, survivors have to be able to engage in a process where they have the maximum amount of choice, self-determination and autonomy, which is kind of what we all enjoy,
sure.
Right? So,
sure.
But oftentimes I think in service delivery, we don't always think about how crucial it is to maximize choice and
Well, I also think, I mean, there's certainly the psychological piece, but it's also about your body. I mean, your body was owned by someone else, used by someone against your will, sort of having to sort of reconnect with that part of yourself.
Right. And we've seen a lot of interesting research coming out of Boston, coming out of some other areas of the country. And even here, we're hoping to do more of it. But some body-based trauma therapy, mm-hmm. using yoga, using other alternatives to intervention that is not your traditional talk therapy.
Let me play something. Someone that called our comment line, and we've got a call from Danielle. Let's hear what she has to say.
My name is Danielle. I am calling from on the road to Harrisburg. And I wanted to ask what your guests think of the safe harbor bills that are currently being reviewed in Harrisburg. One is from Senator Greenlee. The other is from Representative Mark Rossi. And those bills essentially decriminalize the trafficked victims and treat them as victims rather than criminals. So it helps protect them. I just wanted to hear
sure.
their thoughts on the two bills.
Danielle, thanks for calling into our comment line. I know both Shay and Aaron want to respond. I'll start with you, Shay.
Sure. We've been working with Senator Greenleaf for a little over 2 years now to have a piece of legislation become law, safe harbor for sexually exploited children. The crime of prostitution and masking crimes that go along with that, such as obstructing the highway, loitering and prowling, which are charged simultaneously or in lieu of prostitution. We would like to see an immunity bill, which is what's pending in Senate Bill 554 right now, is that children cannot be arrested and charged with the crime of prostitution and obstructing the highway. It's two separate crimes.
Right.
There are five other masking crimes that go along that we're asking that those cases involving those kids start in the dependency system and the child welfare system, because we recognize that these kids need help.
Right.
They don't need to be criminalized in order to get them help.
Right.
And there are 19 states and the District of Columbia that have immunity for children for the crime of prostitution, and Pennsylvania needs to be the 20th state. They really do.
Aaron, you want to add to that?
The Philadelphia District Attorney's Office has been working, has reviewed this legislation. I've spoken extensively to Shea. Our office has spoken. We are in support of the language that's proposed by Senator Greenleaf. We've discussed all of the potential issues. When cases come in, we review them on a case-by-case basis and generally are not criminalizing juveniles at this time already.
An email from Deidre. How does pornography and or strip clubs play into this issue? Jamie, you want to speak to that?
I mean, from working with the victims we have, many have engaged in various forms or been forced into various forms of pornography or other forms of the sex industry. So sometimes, for example, at our center in Kensington, women will talk about both being on a street corner, but then they might also go away for a weekend. And their pimp might use them for pornography, exotic dancing, strip clubs, whatever, parties. So there's...
Like private parties?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So we've kind of... I think that it's important to recognize how trafficking may present itself.
Let me play another call to our caller comment line. And this is Paul from Center City, Philadelphia.
Hi, this is Paul calling from Center City. I just wonder how often the convictions of Johns takes place, how hard it is, especially when it might be a wealthy, perhaps nationally known John. Thank you.
Let me turn to you, Aaron. I mean, does wealth matter or status or any of those things when it comes to prosecuting these crimes?
That certainly doesn't factor into our investigations or our decision to prosecute. If we can conduct an investigation and build a case against a sex buyer, regardless of the background of that person or how they've done it, we will conduct that investigation and prosecute that case fully.
You want to add to that, Shay?
I think that, you know, if we're looking at just the sex buying statute, the majority of individuals, this is nationally, I'm not just speaking specific to Philadelphia or even to Pennsylvania, but they're arrested for a crime that they may or may not even realize is a crime. And, you know, in the criminal justice reform processes nationally, a lot of these individuals are given a diversion program. And a lot of the diversion programs for sex buyers are called John schools.
John schools?
John schools. And so you go through a diversion program and you know, every jurisdiction that has one, they're a little bit different. I know Seattle out in King County in Washington has one that's a 10-week program. And it's educational. It's engaging. Do you have a problem? Do you have a sex addiction? And then they're not necessarily getting a conviction, right? It's going off their record. They can, if they don't engage in criminal activity, they can even have it expunged. And it's like that also for first-time offenders being arrested for the crime of prostitution. I think what law enforcement is really starting to look at, though, is the co-occurring crimes that go along with sex buying, including trafficking. So, like I said before, you need an act by means for a purpose to prove the crime of sex trafficking. And in those acts, you have the words obtains, solicits. That's Pennsylvania law. Mm-hmm. Those two acts are also in the federal law. But in addition to that is patronizes. So if you are – I really encourage law enforcement, especially in the trainings that I give, that in certain circumstances, you should be looking at those sex buyers as traffickers, especially those that are purchasing children for sex because they are patronizing a child for sex. They're a trafficker.
A pedophile too, are they not?
Absolutely. And there are all those co-occurring crimes that go along with that. Statutory sex, rape, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, endangering the welfare of a child, you know, corrupting the morals of a minor. All those co-occurring crimes go along with that. But in certain circumstances, sex buyers are in fact traffickers, especially those that are buying sex from kids.
Right. And what does it cost to have sex? What does it cost? What if, let's say someone wants to have sex with a 15-year-old girl, Jamie. What do they pay? Do we know? Do you know, Aaron? Or
I think we hear a bunch of different numbers. I would say if you're setting up a date on Backpage, it can be as much as $150 for half an hour, and it can go drastically up from there. But this is something that people are unfortunately willing to spend a significant amount of money on.
And does it go up based on certain criteria or the age of the...
It can. It can go up based on the age of the victim, the amount of time, the number of women or girls that you want in the room with you, the number of things that people are engaging in. But it's a significant amount of money that people are expending to buy sex.
And if you look at, I just want to jump in. If you look at the ads on Backpage in other areas, and if you look at this just like economics, right? Supply and demand. You can charge more in the Lehigh Valley.
Because there are fewer choices, so to speak.
Right. And so, and there's the influx of traffickers to those areas like the Lehigh Valley. There's been two successful trafficking prosecutions at the state level, and I know there are more pending in the Lehigh Valley. But the traffickers bring in their victims from, you know, the New York area to that area, and they can charge more, right, than you can in, let's say, Philadelphia, where there's way more supply, which unfortunately is a human being.
Absolutely. Jamie, we talked a little bit about drugs and sex trafficking, but I'm thinking, is there an association between drugs and, let's say, alcohol and sex trafficking? Either someone that has a drug or alcohol problem who then becomes victimized.
So oftentimes what we see is, and we've had victims report that they never had used prior to being trafficked, and that their pimp or trafficker introduced them to control them, not presenting it to them in that capacity, but introducing it at first, maybe as a social activity, maybe as a way to cope. Hey, this will make it easier for you. Or other girls in the stable giving it to another girl, saying, hey, this is, you know, if you get high, it makes it a lot easier. And frankly, I think that's, I think any of us would want to numb that sort of pain or that condition if you had to service, you know, and be raped by, you know, 10 to 15 strangers a night. You would absolutely want to find a way to kind of escape your body during that time period. And so drugs are a natural natural next step of as a way to control somebody. We've also seen traffickers act as a girl, as a dealer as well. So there's this codependency. They might even ask the girls to carry the drugs on them as a way to then also make the victim even further seem as the criminal when she is potentially encountered by law enforcement, or to remain quiet and complacent if law enforcement interacts with her because she knows that she's carrying something that's going to get her arrested.
We have about a minute before we have to say goodbye, and we began by talking about this is something that happens sort of out in the public, and I'm looking at you, Erin. For listeners, what should they look for that might be a sign that there's some kind of sex trafficking going on in a hotel, in a motel, at a sports arena, just all the places we've been talking about?
Well, I think the biggest thing is what we've already talked about, which is looking at those women or looking at those girls, young boys, and seeing them as potential victims and not as the problem, not seeing them as criminals. So when you have people who are in hotels and they're seeing what we know that they're seeing at these hotels around the city and elsewhere, seeing them as potential victims and looking at everything that they're seeing through that lens.
Shay, you want to give us the last word here?
Sure. I mean, we started this whole conversation talking about the hotel industry. The hotel industry really needs to get compliant. They need to train all of their staff, from the front desk staff to the security staff to those that clean the rooms. They need to recognize the signs. Are they seeing a lot of activity, men going in and out of hotel rooms, young girls in the hallway? And they need to call and report that to law enforcement. They absolutely do. And I would suggest to every single hotel that they post in conspicuous places the Human Trafficking Resource Hotline number, which is 1-888-37-37-888. Call the number. If you see something, call it. Report it.
Well, I appreciate all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times, and thank you for your work as well. Shay Rhodes, director and co-founder of the Villanova Law Institute to address commercial sexual exploitation. Jamie Manera-Kiza, director of anti-trafficking for the Salvation Army's New Day to Stop Trafficking program. Erin O'Brien, assistant chief of the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit with the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thank you so much for joining us.